From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today in South Korea, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said it may be necessary to use military action against North Korea. Tillerson made the comments after visiting the armed border that separates the North from the South. He said the U.S. doesn't want a military conflict, but
if they elevate the threat of their weapons program to a level that we believe requires action, that option is on the table.
And then President Trump added on Twitter, North Korea is behaving very badly. They have been playing, the president put quotation marks around the word playing, the U.S. for years. China has done little to help. The president is also meeting with German Chancellor Angela Merkel in Washington today. Of course, Trump was very critical of the chancellor and her immigration policy during his campaign. He's also a big critic of the EU and NATO. So there is lots to talk about with NPR's diplomatic correspondent, Michelle Kellerman. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Robin. Nice to be here.
Nice to speak with you. And start with Tillerson's comments. They were chilling to some. Have past administrations been this explicit? Put this in context.
Well, I mean, I think his remarks were kind of long on tough rhetoric and short on details. This is a policy that's still under review. I've been talking to analysts who say there aren't a whole lot of options to deal with North Korea beyond what the U.S. has been trying, that is, keeping up the pressure, trying to convince the North to give up its nuclear weapons program and get back to talks. And that's basically what Tillerson said he's trying to do, though today he was stressing that all options are on the table now.
Well, we are reading that, other presidents have considered military force behind the scenes, but never so publicly. As you reported on the same trip, Tillerson expressed a tough stance on North Korea's weapons program, but also said North Korea and its people need not fear the United States or their neighbors. So is he trying to play both good cop and bad cop?
I think, Robin, the message has really been all over the place. One day he's defending the Trump administration's plans to slash the foreign affairs budget by saying the U.S. will be involved in fewer military engagements overseas. And the next day, he's raising the prospect of a preemptive military strike on North Korea. I think part of this is really just to get the attention of China. The U.S. needs China to use its influence with North Korea, if anything's really to change, and that's Tillerson's next stop.
Well, you can see maybe perhaps as President Trump seemed to be doing, he directly mentioned China not helping, although you'd think that he would stop using the quotation marks in the tweets around the word playing. But they are dealing with North Korea not considered to be, frankly, a stable, and I mean sane, government. You know, talking about military attacks or military, moves at all, is that going to really raise the stakes?
Well, I think countries in the region, too, could be nervous about that. Remember, he went up to the DMZ today, and you could see how close North Korea is to Seoul. And North Korea has a lot of artillery along that border and could, easily striking distance to Seoul. So South Korea certainly doesn't want to see any kind of military action, certainly not preemptive like that. So I think part of this is really just to get people thinking about what else can we do?
Yeah.
And this is really early stages of this policy review.
Well, talk about Donald Trump's meeting today with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. He has criticized her, as we said, on her immigration policies, on the EU. She has been good friends to past presidents. What is the buzz in diplomatic circles? Is there a common ground?
I think this is another area of mixed messaging from the Trump administration. You know, as you say, he's often very tough, complaining about unfair trade deals or the need for more burden sharing from NATO partners. But his administration did send Tillerson, Vice President Pence, and others to Germany last month to try to reassure the Germans and other NATO countries that the U.S. remains committed to this transatlantic alliance. There's a lot of debate, for instance, about this requirement that NATO countries have to spend 2% of their budget on the military. Trump administration officials have said they're going to press Germany about that. The Germans' response is, we're on track to reach that goal by 2024. That's what NATO agreed to several years ago, and it's this incremental approach that they're planning to continue with.
Well, there have been reports as well that Donald Trump is going to ask Angela Merkel's advice on Vladimir Putin. So we'll see what happens. Michelle Kellerman, NPR diplomacy correspondent, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And as Secretary of State Rex Tillerson prepares for a visit to Beijing tomorrow, our next guest has been listening closely to his statements about North Korea. And as we've been hearing today, Tillerson said that the policy of strategic patience with North Korea has ended and that all options, including military action, are on the table. And to Zheng Wang, these comments are a good first step. He's professor in the School of Diplomacy and International Relations at Seton Hall University, and he says that while Tillerson's comments could be risky, putting the military option on the table is a good way to pressure North Korea. But the question for him remains, if Secretary Tillerson wants a new approach with North Korea, what will it be?
So I think he's correct that we need a new approach to the North Korea nuclear issues. But I think the problem is that I'm probably, you know, what's the new approach to the North Korea nuclear issues?
Right, exactly. Let me just jump in here because, you know, given that he was talking about all sorts of previous diplomatic approaches having failed, I suppose the new approach is the underlying question. I'm seeing here, though, that, you know, there are some conservative observers, for example, Bruce Klinger from the Heritage Foundation. He has said that China has actually been part of the problem rather than part of the solution. Does China need to do more?
Yes, I think one of the major reasons for the failure of the past 20 years is that different countries, they have their own self-interest. A major difficulty for China is that how to work with the United States, actually, to deal with this issue together, rather than, I think, the North Korea in the past, they have been quite smart to deal with the different parties separately.
So if I may ask, this question of China's view on tensions in the region, does the Chinese government look upon President Donald Trump and his administration as viable or effective partners?
I don't think so. But China, actually inside China, there's a lot of discussion and people have a lot of concern, uncertainty. I think when he was just elected, this short period of time, I believe many Chinese, including the officials, they have a high expectation to Donald Trump. Because they thought, okay, Donald Trump is a businessman and he might be a person we can make a deal. But
he's also a businessman that talks tough on trade. He decries the trade deficit that the United States has with China.
Yeah, exactly. So after the phone call with Taiwan, after his several tweets, and I think there's a dramatic change of the attitude inside China as people have a major concern about the U.S.-China relations. But later on, in early February, after, you know, President sent the letter to Chinese President Xi, you know, the things like, you know, changed quite a lot.
So, of course, during the Obama administration, the Obama White House famously said that they were going to undergo an Asia pivot, right? Focusing a lot of diplomatic and economic effort on the United States' relationship with Asia. That's completely gone now, and it's totally changed. So does China feel more empowered, or is China somewhat worried that it doesn't yet know what the American posture towards the Pacific Rim will be?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the Asia pivot is a major concern of China. And now, like you said, the Asia pivot is totally gone. And also the TPP is also gone.
Right.
So this is really good news to China. But I don't think that people are really can, you know, just, they can celebrate, or it's kind of like a real relief for them. Because now they have also a new concern about what will be the Trump administration's China policy. Mm-hmm. And there's a different voice from the, you know, the appointed officials and from the, you know, from the Secretary of State himself, from the other officials, including, for example, Trump appointed Peter Navarro, you know, a major anti-China scholar to be the person in charge of the trade issues. So I think the Chinese side is very concerned about the future orientation of the China policy. And I think another issue is that I think there's a uncertainty is also about the policy making.
Right.
So, for example, who's in charge of the U.S.-China policy? Whether this is the Secretary of State himself or Secretary of State plus Kushner. So I think through this visit of Secretary of State, they're also trying to figure out how the new administration is working and how could they, what is the right process, the right person for them to talk with on the different issues.
Well, Zheng Wang is associate professor in the School of Diplomacy and International Relations at Seton Hall University. Many thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Remember this week's best video? Professor Robert Kelly was doing a Skype interview from home with the BBC when his toddler daughter came bounding into the room.
I would be surprised if they do. Pardon me. My apologies.
Frozen, not taking his eyes off the camera, the professor pushes his daughter away by the face, but around the corner, like a hockey puck, shoots her sibling in a walker. Then a hockey player slides in. That's mom, who hauls both of the kids out. It's been viewed millions of times. And it occurred to us that that professor could have used some emotional agility, defined by our next guest as a science-based approach that allows you to detach from your emotions and embrace life's bumps, especially at work. Psychologist Susan David was born in South Africa. She's now with the Harvard Medical School and the Institute of Coaching at McLean Hospital. And she's worked with leaders at the UN, Ernst & Young, and the World Economic Forum. Her book is Emotional Agility: Get Unstuck, Embrace Change, and Thrive in Work and Life. The Harvard Business Review called it the groundbreaking idea of 2016, and Susan David joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Did you think that also when you saw that man? He was frozen. You write about how sometimes people who don't have emotional agility become like wind-up toys, and we just are rigid and bounce off walls.
Absolutely. When we are dominated by our thoughts or anxieties, what are people going to think? What are they going to say? We often act in ways that are incongruent with maybe our intentions or our values. Right. But what I loved about that clip is the very beautiful humanity, this reminder that we're all doing the best that we can in an imperfect world.
Right. It also reminds me of a woman you write about, talking again about how your own thoughts may often get in your way. You were working with her company. You knew she was in line for a life-changing promotion. You couldn't tell her for professional reasons. And she started to see the people around her acting a little bit differently. But she immediately thought negatively. What happened?
So it was such a fascinating example of the idea that we can get hooked. We can become driven by our thoughts, our emotions, and the stories that we tell ourselves. She became so consumed with the idea that she was actually about to be fired rather than being promoted that she started to shut down in meetings. She started to pull back and ultimately was fired from her job. She landed up acting in ways that were absolutely at odds with her values and her intentions.
You have to tell one more story, and it can be applied to work, where two people are facing off, neither will give. One of them happened to be a ship captain. The ship's sea captain sees, he thinks, another approaching ship, and he tells him to change course. What happens?
He keeps on saying, you know, change course, change right. course, change course, and becoming more and more belligerent. And ultimately, at the end of this play, we recognize that the ship that he sees approaching is actually not a ship, but is a lighthouse.
Yes. They say, sir, we are a lighthouse. You better change course because we can't. I mean, it's just such a great metaphor for how you may be digging in and you're about to crash.
Emotions actually provide a very important guidance system. Like the lighthouse, they actually provide a guidance system. And what starts to happen is we start losing our ability to be effectively guided, to recognize, for example, that so often underneath our difficult emotions, even though they are difficult, are signals to things that we care about, issues of equity and fairness and justice. And so often what we do is when we lose our capacity to recognize that our emotions contain data. They're not directions, but they contain data. We hinder our ability to shape our lives effectively.
Yes, and so you're not saying suppress your negative thoughts. Sometimes someone is messing with you at work. You're saying feel them, step back, analyze them, be more agile. So take us to this idea of inflexibility, what economist Thorstein Veblen called the trained incapacity of experts. I love the anecdote you give about a CEO who might be on a retreat, and let's say all the workers have been thrown into a park. A CEO may not recognize that young guy in the mailroom might have just been discharged from the army and might be the best one to lead them out.
We can so often jump to conclusions about ourselves, about other people. I feel like I'm being undermined, so there's no point in me saying anything. I'm just going to shut down. Or I would really love to put my hand up for that job, but there's no ways that I'm going to get it. What we call premature cognitive commitment. The story is true. The thought is true. The emotion is true. And then we act on that. When we can recognize again that our emotions are data, signals to things that we care about, what we are able to do is to approach those with mindfulness, with compassion, and to notice them. But to also recognize that it's not the thoughts and emotions driving the outcomes, it's rather a mindful, intentional choice.
Well, and you give all sorts of exercises. Again, through this research, there was James Pennybacker. He had people write about their experiences. A computer company laid off 100 senior engineers. What happened when people just wrote about how they felt?
What's really fascinating in human psychology and in emotion psychology is often this idea that when we go through difficult experiences, we should just push them aside and be happy and be smiley. And I actually truly believe that this orientation around happiness and positive thinking is undermining our resilience. What they do here is the opposite. He says to these individuals who have effectively been laid off from their life's work, think about your experience, write about it for 20 minutes a day for 3 days. An alternative group is the control group, and they are asked to write about arbitrary, non-emotionally relevant things. And what James Pennebaker finds is that the individuals who go to their difficult emotions, who start moving this very big and messy emotional experience into something that feels like it's got language and is contained, those individuals, 6 months later, had higher levels of well-being, lower levels of stress, lower levels of anxiety, and they had been rehired quicker. And so this going to emotion, processing emotion, actually helps us to make physical, real changes to our day-to-day reality.
Well, and maybe recasting your reality, having someone have you look at it in a different way does the same thing. I'm thinking of Aaliyah Crum, a professor of psychology who conducted a study of 84 female hotel cleaners. They were exhausted. They were overweight. They were going home to take care of their children after a, 10 however many hour day of cleaning hotel rooms. And they were living on caffeine and sugar. Well, she recast it for half of them. She told them, and it was true, that the work they were doing during the course of the day actually met the Surgeon General's guidelines for exercise.
And what they found is that these individuals, where they had this shift in perception, gee, this thing that I'm doing is actually exercise, that what it led to was changes in their body mass index, in their cholesterol, in a whole range of outcomes. Now, while we don't fully understand the mechanisms that underpin that, what we do know is that the way we think about our world can in many ways direct our behavior. So, for example, if I had to ask listeners, do you believe that as you get older, life will get worse? What's fantastically interesting in research, for example, Becca Levy from Yale University, and what she finds is that when people go into aging with a mindset that things are going to get worse, these negative mindsets about aging actually impact in negative ways on people's health outcomes.
Well, even though, as you point out, studies show seniors make fewer errors at work relative to their younger counterparts, aspects of thinking and memory do improve with age. But I just have one question. Why is addressing yourself in the third person, as LeBron James does, why is that good for you? That feels weird to me.
So a critical human skill, in fact, it is a skill that underpins our ability to empathize, to perspective take, is development of this meta view. This idea that you can feel an emotion or you can think a thought. I'm so terrible at this thing. And yet you can also notice that emotion for what it is and almost be able to observe it. So one of the skills that we know is critical in this is being able to address yourself in the third person. If you are really struggling with a situation at work, you can't see a solution. When you say, for example, to yourself, what would the wisest person that I know advise on the situation? Or what should Susan do in the situation? What you're doing is you are starting to develop that meta emotion capacity, which is to give yourself a different perspective.
It's like when LeBron James decided to go to Miami, he said, I want to do what's best for LeBron James and to do what makes LeBron James happy. And he did. Susan David, her book is Emotional Agility, Get Unstuck, Embrace Change, Thrive in Work and Life. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
And by the way, you can test your emotional agility. Go to herenow.org and this piece and click on the Take the Emotional Agility Quiz button. Hey, it's St. Patrick's Day. A quick note before the break. New York City's parade is the oldest. It's heading down Fifth Avenue today. This year's parade is dedicated to Catholic Charities and the New York State Police, both of which turn 100 this year. Chicago had its parade last weekend. The Chicago River was green. There was a near crisis in Boston. The parade organizer, the Allied War Veterans Council of South Boston, voted 9-4 to ban out vets. That's a group of gay and lesbian veterans because their logo is too sexual. It's a rainbow. Well, the mayor, the governor, other groups all said in which case they would not attend. So the organizers backed down. Now everyone will step off this Sunday. Happy St. Patrick's to all. It's Here and Now.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 200 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 500 companies and hundreds of thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson, and I want you to take a minute right now to think about the people you love. Have they ever listened to a podcast? Do they even know podcasts exist? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media, and if they don't know how to download a podcast, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a whole new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag tripod. That's hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks.
Today's cars are filled with computer code, and concerns about hacking have led dozens of companies to try and develop software to secure them. Paul Flab from Texas Public Radio takes a look at one effort between NYU and the Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio, Texas.
Someone looking to hack into your car probably isn't trying to get your financial data, but the results could be far more damaging.
Okay, hold on tight. Hold on.
That's Wired Magazine's Andy Greenberg in a Jeep Cherokee being gently driven into a ditch by a couple of hackers. These guys could disable Greenberg's brakes, turn off his transmission, or fool with dozens of other functions while they sit in a living room miles away, all by hacking into the computer for the car's entertainment system.
The air conditioning is blasting, the music is blasting, and I can't see anything because of the windshield wiper fluid.
We're gonna do it.
Some car manufacturers are taking this seriously. Here's GM CEO Mary Barra at a tech summit last year.
Cybersecurity is one of the most serious challenges we face, and we need to make it an industry priority.
There are between 50 to 100 computers in modern cars that run everything from your engine and automatic transmission to your airbag and steering. Many of those computers are networked together, and as cars become more complex, they need to be updated.
If you can exploit an update system, it is like the golden entryway into the system.
That's NYU professor of engineering Justin Kappos. He says all the computers are networked but made by different vendors. So without cybersecurity standards, it's getting easier and easier to hack car computers. Right now, Kappos says it's only researchers who are doing the hacking.
But it would not surprise me if we started to see people with more criminal intent or nation state actors start to launch these types of attacks in the near future.
Capo says if you can hack into one car computer, you can probably hack into a fleet of the same car. He and his collaborators, backed by Department of Homeland Security money, have come up with what may be the beginnings of protection for these vulnerable computer updates. It's called Uptane. The software just launched this year, and Southwest Research Institute scientist Cameron Mott says that GPAC we heard before would not have been possible with Uptane.
That update would have been detected and refused by the ECU. It would have been able to perform its own protection against that kind of particular attack.
That's the hope anyway. Mott, Capos, and their research teams are asking white hat or ethical hackers to tear their anti-hacking protection apart and find vulnerabilities.
Already there's been some investigations into the code that have then resulted in someone suggesting an improvement that could be made that was accepted.
This isn't a silver bullet, they say. It's the beginning. And now is the ideal time. Car hacking is in its infancy. As cars become more complex with computers that allow driverless vehicles and greater internet connectivity, remote software updates are expected to proliferate.
This is that perfect spot for being able to incorporate these kinds of elements into the design process and make sure that things are being future-proofed for efforts that are coming up soon.
Uptane is by no means the only solution to protecting your car from hacking. Companies like Argus Cybersecurity, Harman, and Movimento all sell security as a service to the automotive industry. Uptane open sources the solution. Unburdened from commercial aspirations, it is pushing the auto industry to adopt a standard that is consistent, transparent, and verifiable. Right now, Uptane has been integrated by two automotive parts suppliers with nearly a half dozen more in talks. For Here and Now, I'm Paul Flav.
All this week, we've been exploring different aspects of our current healthcare system and the potential impact of the House Republicans' plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Now, since it's Congress that's going to vote on these changes, today we thought we'd look at the insurance Congress itself gets and how do lawmakers pay for it. Many people believe they get free healthcare. They don't. Many others say they should have to buy plans through the Affordable Care Act. They already do. Dylan Scott is Washington correspondent for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. He's with us now. Hi there, Dylan.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
All right. So first of all, a lot of people are confused for understandable reasons on how health insurance works for members of Congress. So set us straight. What is the situation for House and Senate members right now?
Sure. So broadly speaking, lawmakers are supposed to buy their insurance through the marketplaces that were set up under Obamacare. And that was part of a big fight dating back to when the law was being drafted before it was passed. But they're supposed to go on the marketplaces and buy insurance. And for the most part, the one sort of hitch, the way that they're different from normal people who are going on the marketplaces of buying coverage, is they are still receiving, by and large, the employer contribution that they would that they used to get from the federal government. So they're just treated in a way as normal employees whose employer pays a big chunk of their health insurance bill premiums, but they have to buy the insurance through the marketplaces.
I see. So that sort of presages what was going to be my next question. A lot of people think there's this petition on change.org right now, and more than a half a million people have signed it saying that they believe that Congress should, quote, remove health care subsidies for members of Congress and their families. So is that that demand makes sense in the context of they're getting a chunk of the money of their health care costs from the federal government?
Right. So it's an interesting backstory, and this has popped up both when Obamacare was drafted and a couple times since it has passed. The way it was originally supposed to work, or so everybody thought, is that not only would lawmakers and their have to purchase health insurance through the Obamacare's marketplaces, but they would not get the employer contribution that they were currently, you know, getting from the federal government when they had normal federal government health insurance. And part of the reason was, and that was Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa's idea. And if anybody knows Chuck Grassley, he's very into this. It should be fair, and Congress should have to live with the consequences of their own legislation. But that was the original kind of baseline that everybody thought was going to happen when Obamacare passed. But what the Obama administration decided was that, no, even though the lawmakers do need to go on the marketplaces and buy their insurance that way, they can still receive the employer base, their employer contribution from the federal government to help to pay for it. And so that's the criticism that you've heard come up a few times since then, that yes, the members of Congress have to go on the marketplaces and buy health insurance there, but they're able to do something that nobody else is able to do, which is use money from their employer to do it. And several times, some of the most conservative Republicans have said, no, we should nix that employer contribution for ourselves. But thus far, it hasn't happened. Although some lawmakers have voluntarily declined to take their federal government contribution. But obviously, you know, your average member of Congress is wealthier than your average American. And so they're probably better situated to handle a bigger insurance.
I was just going to say that we're not necessarily talking about many, if any, members of Congress who come from a background where they were earning the minimum wage before joining Congress. So, but do we know sort of which plans most of the members have chosen? Because, of course, you do have a choice on the exchanges.
That is a great question. I have not seen any detailed analysis of what kind of coverage lawmakers are buying. I don't think they're under necessarily any obligation to disclose. I know some of them have, especially the ones who have very kind of dramatically and publicly said that they're going to buy the going to decline the employer contribution from the federal government, have also said that they're going to buy some of these higher deductible plans that normal people are often buying because they're cheaper, but and then are frustrated because of the out of pocket costs that come with them. Point being, I don't know in a systematic way, but it'll be interesting to see, you know, as insurance coverage changes under the new, if this new law is passed, to see what kind of, if lawmakers are again given more choice about what kind of insurance to have.
Okay, let me just jump in here, Dylan, here, because this was I wanted to go next. At a press conference yesterday, House Speaker Paul Ryan did comment on this because he was asked exactly what you were just raising, where he thinks members of Congress should get their insurance under the new plan if the Republican reform plan passes. And here's what Speaker Ryan said.
I haven't given thought to that. I don't know the answer. When you get rid of Obamacare, you don't have Obamacare. We have Obamacare. We wouldn't have Obamacare. I haven't given any thought to that.
So Dylan, okay, so House Speaker Ryan says he hasn't given any thought to that, but say the bill passes, there still is a federal health insurance plan, right, that many other federal employees use.
That's right. And yeah, I should say from the outset that it's just not clear, to Speaker Ryan's point, the man most well acquainted with this legislation. If he hasn't given it a lot of thought, then clearly we don't have a clear answer to what's going to happen. There are a few wrinkles, though, that are interesting. First of all, because of the complex procedural rules that Republicans have to use to pass this bill without any Democratic support, they are not able to repeal the provision in Obamacare that required them to buy insurance on the marketplaces in the first place. And so that requirement that was set up under the ACA is not being repealed. And so one would think in theory that lawmakers and their staffs would still be, statutorily obligated to buy insurance through the marketplaces, which the law is not doing away with. On the other hand, there's two other things. Chuck Grassley, again, he is kind of a recurring character in this issue, has said that whatever we end up passing in whatever insurance market it creates, members of Congress and their staff should have to buy insurance through it. And so he's already clearly thought of this and is on this train, and that'll be something to watch, both because it's a politically potent point, and Chuck Grassley is, chairman of a powerful Senate committee. If he says something, we should probably pay attention to it. And the one other thing that I've seen brought up here in the last couple of days as this issue has started to percolate is if Republicans were to say, actually, to create this new insurance market that will inevitably have a lot of uncertainty, and we've seen some of the projections about people losing coverage, if they were to say, while we're creating this new insurance system, we're going to allow ourselves to move back to the old, rather generous and quite good federal insurance that we used to have before Obamacare, that opens up a pretty easy line of attack from Democrats. Now, whether that's enough to really stop them, that's something we'll have to wait and see.
So given all this, where does the prospects for the House bill stand now? I mean, it did pass the House Budget Committee yesterday, and today President Trump said he's 100% behind it. I'm seeing a plan for a full House vote sometime in the second half of next week. What do you think its prospects are?
I try not to be a prognosticator, but I will say, you know, they're set to vote next Thursday. So clearly, House leadership is serious about keeping this thing moving. I don't think they want it to get bogged down by all the things that are already seeming to stand in its way. President Trump, as you said, had a meeting with a big conservative caucus inside the Republican conference today, and he seems to think that he has a big chunk of those people who had been skeptical of the plan on board. However, I saw the House Freedom Caucus from their official Twitter account, and that's a group of about 40 of the most conservative people in the House. Their caucus Twitter account tweeted out that they still oppose the House bill as it exists, despite some of these concessions that President Trump and House leadership are trying to give to get conservatives on board. And so if those guys are serious, those 40 members of the Freedom Caucus are dedicated to opposing this bill unless they get more of what they want, that's enough to start it right, to stop the bill right there. And then on the other hand, and this is the push-pull that leadership has been dealing with from the start, if they make even more concessions to try to get the Freedom Caucus on board, then you have the moderate side of the Republican conference, who is clearly already a little on edge about this plan, that might push them to feeling like they can't support it. So it's hard to say. It really is. It's a very thin margin of error that they're working with.
And I was just going to jump in here because we didn't even talk about the skittish senators on the other side of Congress.
Oh, yeah, and that's not even getting right. Not even getting to the Senate. Right. That's just getting it through the House.
Well, Dylan Scott is Washington correspondent for our partners at STAT. Dylan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Royal Robbins has died. Now, you might be thinking, Royal Robbins, that's a clothing line. I have the hiking gear. Well, it is, and you probably do, and it was founded by Royal Robbins, the man who's said to have done more to define the rules and the culture of climbing today than anyone. He was a rock climbing legend and an advocate of clean climbing, climbers leaving no trace on the rock behind them. He and his wife, Liz, founded the Royal Robbins Clothing Company. He has died at 82. Climber and writer John Long joins us by Skype from California. John, when did you first meet Royal Robbins?
I first met him like so many people, young climbers. I first met him sort of by proxy because back then there weren't a lot of routes and climbing areas. So the places that we went to had Robbins' hand and footprints all over it because he had done everything 25 years before. So I met him that way. But physically, I never met him. I didn't meet him until I was perhaps 20 years old and was sort of the new hot shot, just as Robbins had been a couple generations before. And that was... that was in 1978, I believe.
Well, boy, as you say, he left his hand and footprints. He's said to have ushered in what's known as the Golden Age of Climbing in Yosemite. In 1957, he and Jerry Galwas and Mike Sherrick were the first to climb the northwest face of Half Dome. I mean, talk about some of the other places that maybe you followed in his footsteps and handprints.
Robbins made his name and put American rock climbing on the map by the stuff he did in Yosemite because... the iconic formations like El Capitan, Half Dome, Leaning Tower, Washington Column, all of those had been burned into mankind's collective memory by Ansel Adams and any number of other people who had been photographing that stuff as the world's grandest sort of rock faces. And it had the advantage of having, one, perfect rock, and two, having perfect weather. And those don't come in combination very often. So Yosemite was the perfect place to be able to invent all the new techniques that were necessary to climb rocks of that magnitude. And Robbins was at the head of that. It was like open seas back in those days. Nobody knew hardly how to sail a boat, so to speak. And they invented the thing as they went along. A lot of the techniques, a lot of the equipment, and the mindset necessary to tackle those. I mean, you can't understate how courageous those people were in going up on those rocks back in, you know, 50 years ago when the materials, the techniques, and the equipment were so terrifically caveman and crude. It was amazing.
Well, let me jump in because he was born and grew up working class poor in Southern California. He learned to climb in the 1950s at some granite outside Los Angeles. And you say that, you know, when he was doing these really dangerous climbs in the U.S., he was using, and I'm quoting you now, cheap-ass tennis shoes and, you know, some yachting rope. I mean, this was not the equipment, as you say, we have today. How courageous, how brave?
Well, let me put it this way. He did the first multi-pitch 5.9 rap, 5.9 being a rating system, but it's still today considered sort of the threshold to expert terrain. And the climb is named Open Book. It's the Takis Rock, which is down by Palm Springs, really iconic play, 800-foot-high granite plug. Today, people walk up to it with modern nylon ropes, you know, sticky rubber shoes, NASA-engineered gear, mm-hmm. and oftentimes have a fairly stiff time at trying to even do it. Robbins first free climbed this thing, as you mentioned, with a white line gold, you know, rope, Sears tennis shoes, virtually no protection, nothing in the crack to arrest a fall, and and he was 17 years old. Mm-hmm. That was in 1950. So, you know, even now the things he did back in the day are considered to be bold. But given the gear that he had, if you put that same gear on even a world-class climber today, they would go back and have their hands full doing what he did, you know, well, half a century ago.
Well, and I want to mention his wife, Liz Robbins. They met at Camp 4, this wild climbing camp in Yosemite in 1963 and 67. They climbed Half Dome together. She was the first woman to climb it. And apparently she was wearing these cutoffs. Well, you can see the picture. We'll show you. In this picture, they snapped at the top. And that inspired the clothing line. These cutoff shorts in that year, you know, hugely popular. And now, you know, people who may not even know about their role in climbing wear the Royal Robbins clothing. Just your thoughts, John Long, who also did some tremendous climbing. Your thoughts on the passing of Royal Robbins, just to sum us up here.
The guy was a transcendent climber in every way. That generation of Yosemite climbers actually gave liftoff to the entire adventure sports world. Out of that world came Royal Robbins. It came Chouinard and Patagonia. It came Doug Tompkins and North Face, which eventually made all the equipment that you see on everything from sorority girls to Wall Street, you know, stockbrokers. So the imprint of that generation, and Robbins in particular, is giant. And he transcended climbing. He was an American treasure. What he did was like walking on the moon. There will never be another Royal Robbins.
That's climber and writer John Long. John, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Walking on the Moon. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's salute the grandeur of the Big Wall in Yosemite.
Yeah.
This is Here and Now.